Forgotten Flicks, Episode 7, The Night of the Comet, Special, Super Duper Deluxe Criterion, Director's Cut, Not Circumcised Edition. What the hell was that noise?
Sorry, my dog just shook.
Oh, I was like, get your hand out of your pants. Okay, well, here we are. We're back. Episode 7 of Forgotten Flicks. The last episode was, of course, the wonderful Kelly Maroney and the interview that we had with her, which was totally awesome. So I am Joel. I probably should mention that as opposed to completely leaving that part out.
But who are you?
I'm Joel, I think, last time I checked. And I'm with my co-host, as always, the lovely Jason.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Let's go kill ourselves as a zombie. So, anywho, we are here with episode 7, and we got a whole lot of stuff to cover tonight, even though we're really only focusing on one movie. And Jason, what is that one movie?
One fantastic movie, the genre-defying Night of the Comet from 1984.
Yes. And, of course, this ties us back into two weeks ago episode. And I think actually to kick things off, we're going to do things a little bit differently. We're going to start with feedback because we got a couple pieces of feedback and they related to episode 5, The Adventures of Babysitting and Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead episode. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go ahead and listen to that. And once it's done, we will address a couple points that were made in it because I think they made some really cool points. And then we will carry on with our next segment. So without any further ado, here is the voicemail.
What's up, most excellent dudes of Forgotten Flicks? This is Umar, otherwise known as the Fixer in certain law enforcement circles. I just want to comment on your babysitter show. You actually talked about movies I actually seen. I've seen all of them and still enjoy them no matter how dated they are, including Labyrinth, Adventures in Babysitting, and Don't Tell Mama the Babysitter's Dead. I actually took some kids to see that. They wanted to see it back then. Also, I want to suggest a topic because I was reading your blog on movies you should see from, 1989 and 1988, and I came across the posting about Night of the Comet. And in it, you said you defy anyone to define the movie, classify as genre. And I think that's a good topic for you guys. Movies that defy description, such as Weird Science, which is a movie I can watch over and over and over again, even though I saw it in the movies. I had the VHS. I have now had the DVD. Night of the Comet, like you mentioned. Videodrome is another one that, while people think it might have a genre, watch it again. It kind of defies genres. Brazil, which defies every genre. You can't decide whether it's going to be a science fiction, a comedy, a science fiction comedy. I'm not sure what it was. And my favorite genre-defying movie, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is when I gained respect for Johnny Depp, because as a younger person, I watched 21 Jump Street and took a lot to get some respect for that man. But Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas totally defies genre. So if you decide to come up with that topic, I think it'd be a great one. Also, sometimes, speaking of Weird Science, you have to work that in. Weird Science is just too much for a classic not to work in. Well, keep the good shows coming, and I'll keep listening. Peace.
Hey, this is Daryl. I love the show. Listen to episode 5. Really, really loved it. Babysitters, the world's most dangerous job. Me and my friend went to go see Adventures in Babysitting when we were kids, and I loved that movie. And I know it doesn't hold up as much, but I still like this movie better than I liked I Know the Babysitter's Dead, even though both of them are both funny and fun films. But I don't know, for whatever reason, with all the plot holes and all that you can see, I still like that one better. I think it's something with Elizabeth Shue. I just have a crush on her. Maybe that's what it is. But I do think back to it seems that we always have this reoccurring theme in a lot of movies where you have the scary black guy, or you're in the scary neighborhood, which is usually all black or a black or Hispanic neighborhood, and if the character is a white suburban whites, they go into that situation, and then you find that the real scary black guy is really, he has a heart of gold and he helps the character. It's still kind of a stereotype to show that on the outside the guy usually looks like he just got out of prison, and he gets misjudged in the movie. I mean, it's just used so many times in so many different films that it's just something. I mean, yeah, as a black man, you know, you look at it and you go, because that same guy that looks like the scary black guy, to me, since I am black, he's not the scary black. I'm a kind of a big dude, so I get that look too from someone who doesn't, who hasn't been around black people, or don't get it, or don't know that I'm not a criminal, never been in jail, you know. So I kind of sit back and I look and I go, that looks like he could be my uncle or somebody, or that could be me on screen. You know, you just prejudge the person. So it's kind of a, but then you don't want to be overly sensitive about every film, or else you'll never enjoy anything, you know, because films do use stereotypes, whether it's the Irish person who's drunk all the time, the alcoholic, or the Asian character who always knows kung fu. You know, there's always some type of stereotype that are in films. It's just what they do. So, I mean, you just have to, I don't know, you pick and choose, and you try to, you look at what the director or the writer of the film is trying to get across to someone, what they're trying to get across to the audience, and you can tell whether or not it's whether it works or not. Because in Transformers 2, it didn't work. Those stereotypes in Transformers 2 did not work, to the point where it took me out of the film, and I wound up not liking the film a lot because of it. So, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's a complex thing, you know, and I guess it merits discussion at times. I mean, it was worse back in the 80s and the 70s, but it's a little bit better now to a point, and you hope it gets even better as more people get around to more places and meet other people, and so you just don't have so many of these stereotypes all the time. But it is what it is. Love the show. Keep doing the show. I really look forward to each episode when it comes out. So, all right. Take care, y'all.
Okay, so that was Umar DaFixer and Daryl, who is also on Umar's podcast, The DaFixer's Hideout. So you guys check these guys out, DaFixer's Hideout. excuse me, I'm clearing my throat. Daryl also does a podcast called No Apologies, so you can check him out there, and I'm going to put all that stuff in the show notes. You can, you know, if you don't want to try and remember all that, it'll be there for you. So they made some very good points, I think. Jason, do you want to address either one first? Or
Yeah, both. Actually, I know we kind of talked about this a little bit in the babysitting episode.
Yeah.
Daryl made a point of kind of the racial stereotypes, and I agree with him. I actually agree with him a lot that I thought of some of the, especially the carjacking guy that we talked about a little bit. It did seem a little stereotypical that they immediately considered the bad part of town, that it was racially divided. But, you know, I think it's what we've talked about in the past, kind of a product of the 80s. There are a lot of movies that, you know, we saw a lot of that with, and even some gender stuff. You know, we've talked about this, that some of the stuff about homosexuality, you've heard a couple of comments, and even in Night of the Comet comment, we'll talk about, there was a comment made that maybe just feels a little bit out of space nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, but for the time frame, yeah, there was definitely some cinema stereotypes in that. But I agree with him, Daryl, because I definitely thought that the guy that was the tow truck driver, he looks like at least two of my uncles. So
you don't want to go to Jason's family.
You do not. Thanksgiving
when the banjo music kicks in, I swear to God, Just grab your butt and head for the hills. That's all I'm saying. I'm not going to say anything else.
Listen, there are a lot of long white beards and more than one hook in my family.
Actually, the confusion becomes, are we at a ZZ Top concert or are we at Jason's family reunion? And that's where all the confusion sets in.
My Thanksgivings are fun. That's all I got to say. So
yours are a hairy people, Jason. Yes. Yours are a hairy people. So anyway, but, he makes some good points. And actually, I think... I don't remember if you made this point the last time when we originally had the discussion, but I remember you said some things about the tow truck driver. And to be fair, the black carjacker is not, that's not his neighborhood. That's the tow truck driver's neighborhood, hence why his wife is there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's where his wife is.
It's actually a very, it's the tow truck driver that's, I think sort of being depicted as being, let's just say, less than... high class.
But he was the scariest to me as a kid.
And honestly, the carjacker to me, actually the problem with the carjacker is the guy they cast. I didn't find him really, and then I'm a grown man now, but I didn't think he was like, didn't even put off like a scary vibe at all to me. Like you said, the tow truck driver was definitely had a much scarier angle to him. But
what's funny is the tow truck driver, he reminded me of more of Large Marge from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Yeah.
And when they pulled the twisted, mangled body out of the wreck, it looked like this.
Like this. Look!
Sorry. Yeah.
So anyway, great call, Daryl. And for anybody who hasn't listened to Fix Your Side Out, is actually a really funny podcast.
Yes, it's awesome. Oh, and wait. This is important.
Yep.
We have to think, Umar, because, and I don't think we ever addressed this last time. Shame on us. I can't remember if I did or not. I think maybe you told me I did, and now I'm completely brain farting. But this last time, I think it was episode 180 of The Fixer's Hideout, they named us as one of their top podcasts, specifically called out a couple of our recent episodes, which was very, very, very cool of them. They've done that once before, and we really appreciate that. And Umar's feedback was really cool. And, I love that, he addressed those movies that he had seen them and, the ones that he enjoyed. But I really liked what he, the idea he gave us about doing an episode about movies that defy genre, that you can't just easily say, oh, this is a comedy, this is a science fiction film, this is a horror film. So, and I think Night of the Comet qualifies.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think there's a lot of movies. I think it's our nature to try and put things in category.
Yeah.
And it's easy, especially when you talk about cinema, because you have things like, movie rental houses or places that you want to search by genre. But there are a lot of movies that really it's just a piece of art and it doesn't really come with a label on it. And it's up to us to kind of put some of those labels on. And I like his example of the Weird Science, because at first blush you think, well, it's kind of a comedy, but it's kind of sci-fi in there a little bit too. And but there are lots of movies that are like that. So I agree. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Put your fears to rest, Umar, because we are definitely going to be talking about Weird Science. That's a for sure. Kelly LeBrock.
Well, not to mention the fact that I don't think Umar's got any fears, and if anything, maybe it's more of a fear of us just continuing to talk. So
it's a fear that our podcast will last.
No, I don't think he feels that way at all. But what's cool is that this is something I was going to tell you, and I didn't mention it before, so this is the first time you're actually hearing it. But I was listening to somebody recently who was talking about, and actually this guy that I've mentioned before called the Podcast Answer Man, and he always gets in like the techie part of podcasting, and he made a comment that in his experience, and so it's totally anecdotal, but I thought he made a good point, which was, if you get people who get to the 7th episode of their podcast, that in his experience, like 80% or better of them continue on. And if you get to the 10th episode, you usually have a successful show in the vein of like a The Fixer's Hideout, where you've done hundreds of episodes. So I just kind of think this is a special, it's not just special because we're talking about Night of the Comet, but it's special because it's our 7th episode. So...
yay!
We've lasted that long. Holy crap.
It feels like it has been 10 years.
Well, especially with the hour that it took to get all the bugs worked out prior to recording this. I'm already so wasted.
You put a couple of amateurs on there.
Yeah, really, no kidding. So anyway, that was great feedback, guys. We really appreciate it. And anybody else, we'll give the feedback number at the end of the show here. And we really appreciate the feedback, people taking the time to tell us what they think. And, I thought they both made really good points. And, I didn't get to say much about Daryl because somebody else was yakking a lot. I'm not going to name names about who they are. Just kidding. One thing I wanted to address with Daryl's is that I like that he brings that different perspective, you know, where he made the point that, you know, as a black man, to him, it, you know, it's just anybody else. It's not, you know, and it's funny, but there's an assumption just sort of inherent in those stories that the majority of the audience is going to take, you know, any of that a certain way, that they're going to take it as, oh, this is a scary guy. You got to be, mm-hmm. Oh, they're in a bad part of it. And it's funny, but that assumption is kind of loaded, you know, with that racial idea. So
yeah.
I just thought it was just kind of cool, you know, to hear his point of view on it. And yeah, that was pretty much all I wanted to say. So
yeah, definitely. That was, I like how it was.
Yeah.
Points.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess with that out of the way, we will now go into the kind of new segment, because we did it once before and then completely forgot to do it in episode 5. And we are calling it what, Jason?
What have you seen lately?
Insert clever music here.
One of us really needs to learn how to play an instrument.
Yeah, I know.
Sure.
It's really sad. I can play the kazoo, kind of. Oh, I'm going to do a kazoo. That's what I'll do. I'll do like little theme music for each segment using a kazoo.
Oh, that would be awesome.
And annoying all at the same time. So, yeah. So what, you know, what you seen lately? Is that what you called it? Yeah, that's what you called it.
What have you seen lately?
What have you seen lately? That's really hard to remember, Joel. Come on. Stay with us. And
can I play some cowbell to get in there?
Yeah, really.
What this needs is more cowbell.
Yeah, more cowbell. Hey, I love that song. That skit pisses me off. Don't Fear the Reaper is a great damn song. I don't care who you are. Blue Oyster Cult rules. I'm doing the devil sign with my fingers right now, like I actually was a rock and roller, you know. So anyway, so Jason, what you seen lately?
Oh my gosh, wow! Since our Kelly Maroney interview, I've actually seen a bunch of stuff, and but there are two things I wanted to bring up real quick that I've seen lately that I want to talk to you about. Number one was Empire of the Ants. You know, it's one of those classics. If you haven't seen it, Joan Collins. I hadn't seen it in. God, I can't even remember how long it's been. It's been 15, 20 years. It's 1977. It's Joan Collins, Robert Lansing, a typical, you know, kind of classic giant ants revenge kind of movie. But
oh, those are classic.
Oh, my gosh. It was one of those just wonderful, campy, cheesy movies that you can just let go. And it doesn't matter that all of the effects are really bad and that there are giant plot holes. You just kind of revel in the overacting and over drama.
Yeah.
Oh, it was awesome. So
well, and I would also like to point out that that's called brilliant cross promotion. Thank you, Jason, because
<You're welcome. laughs>
Jason, actually, if you haven't checked it out yet, has a review up on the website, because by the time we're recording this, it's long since been out, and it's under the deep fried reviews section. And because it was kind of a deep fried. We came up with this whole thing about the movies being cheesy and then deep fried. And so it's like deep fried reviews. That sounds good. So he is going to do every couple of weeks, he's going to do a review, which is awesome. And usually they'll be around a work of staggering genius like Empire of the Ants. And
well, your taste might be a little more highbrow. Tend to be a little more campy, eclectic, and cheeseball.
One of the reasons why we're friends, Jason, is because around you, my tastes are actually considered highbrow.
I know.
Do you know the stank eye I used to get as a kid when I'd like have a cousin come over and show him Evil Dead 2 or, you know, bust out, you know, Maniac Cop or what have you? They did not see it as highbrow. You, however, you're like, you're such an elitist.
Evil Dead.
Oh, my God.
Dead. What a stuffing.
Oh, my God. Shocker. Deadly Friend. Oh, you film snob. So anyway,
chopping mall.
Yeah, chopping mall. Hey, don't give it away yet. So anyway,
so that was my campy one. Yes. But the other one I wanted to get into a little bit more of this time was a recommendation you gave me.
Uh-oh.
And if I may tell a little story, you had sent me some messages, and I saw some interchange with you and one of our listeners on Twitter about a movie you watched called Frozen. And it's a recent movie.
Oh, well, hold on, real quick, Jason. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I just want to make sure, because let me just explain, folks, this is what you call poking the hornet's nest.
I'm trying.
That's what he's trying to do.
I'm trying really
because
hard.
He knows that if I get started on something, A, it's hard to shut me up, and B, let's just say I might get a little heated. So go ahead, Jason. Tell us what you think about Frozen.
This is absolutely why we will never do a podcast on the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, because... no, dude, we totally will. Episode 140 to Fictions Hideout, that's exactly, it was what they were talking about. It was, you know, Star Wars movies, and they got into the prequels and stuff.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing wrong with somebody else talking about it. It's getting you wound up on it.
Let me just get started. You know, just since you opened up that Pandora's box, just real quick, I want to make one point. It's very simple, George. Very simple. The prequels should echo the originals. Echo, George, okay? That means Anakin should be Luke-ish age, just to start with. Not, yippee, I'm Annie. I'm sorry, and I will stop it there, folks, because if I don't, this will be a 4.5-hour podcast just on Phantom Menace and that godforsaken pod racer scene. Oh, my God, I'm on the edge of my seat. What will happen? Will he win? Will he get out of his servitude? Oh, wait, he becomes Darth Vader, but no, it can't be. Sorry.
Okay, wait, what episode are we on? Seven?
Yes, seven.
Okay, you realize 3 of the 7 episodes you have now made Star Wars references.
Have I really?
Yes.
And the worst part is, I am a original trilogy fan. I mean, I'm not as, you know, completely diehard like into the deep, you know, the mythology. I totally appreciate people that can do that. That's incredible and impressive. But I'm a huge fan of the movies, you know, regardless. But yeah, the prequels. Although what's so sad, dude. My level of hypocrisy is amazing because I still saw Phantom Menace 5 effing times in the movie theater.
Yeah, right.
And I saw Attack. It's just funny. This is how it went. 5 times Phantom Menace, 2 times Attack of the Clones, 1 time Revenge of the Sith. Everybody's going to say, well, good God, man, Revenge of the Sith is the best one. Yeah, but I think I literally had such a taste of copper in my mouth from biting my tongue. Yeah, it was bad. It was so bad. And at least Phantom Menace had Darth Maul. At least it had Darth Maul.
So, Frozen.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's what we were talking about, wasn't it?
Poking the hornet's nest.
Tangent.
Here. Maybe I should say, no, I haven't seen Frozen. I haven't yet. I know where your hot buttons are. At the very least, I can say that.
Uh-huh.
So, you said that Frozen was an emotional roller coaster for you.
Yes, it was.
Contemporary movie. Actually came out last year. And it was about 3 friends who went on the very last run of the night down the ski slope in Vermont, and they went up on the ski lift when they weren't supposed to, and the guy kind of let them in, and these things happened, and they got stuck up there. Now, not only did they get stuck up there.
Now, be careful. Make sure you hit spoiler alert if you are going to go.
I'm not going to tell anything bad.
Okay.
I'm not going to give any spoilers. And they get stuck up there. And if you didn't guess that by the movie poster, which shows a picture of a ski lift hanging over the slopes, then
you've ruined the biggest plot twist.
Yeah. So anyhow, they get stuck up there. And then it, you know, goes through their story and kind of this emotional roller coaster of what happens and what to do and all that. And I remember seeing your tweets of how emotional it was and how it touched you more than any movie you'd seen in a long time, and it was just it made you feel exciting. I didn't get it, man. It was bleh. It was bleh. I remember watching it thinking, and this is a spoiler alert, so fast forward 20 seconds. Ready? Starting now. Dude, I was rooting for that girl to get run over at the end.
Oh God, you're such a douche. No, let me break this down, bro. I'm gonna give my review of Jason. Cold, heartless bastard. How do you get to the end of that movie? Like, seriously, my reaction was exactly the opposite. And if you've just caught back up with us after his little spoiler, I'm not going to say what he said, but it's at the end of the movie. And for me, I was like, I swear to God, if that happens, I'm going to go out of my friggin' mind. It better not happen.
It wasn't a bad movie. And one of the things I will say is that I'm not generally a fan of those, what I would probably call phobia movies, which would be something.
I think it's a survival movie. I mean, it was more.
Well, I mean, it is survival. It is. But it's also one of those, like, I don't want to equate it to this because, you know, I've had this conversation recently, but Buried or.
That was going to be the one I was going to bring up.
Yeah, Phone Booth and some of those that are like this one location, which I think is an amazing feat from a filmmaker's perspective. And I will give them that the fact that most of this movie is shot up on that ski lift it was very well done from that perspective. So from a filmmaker's perspective, mm-hmm. and kind of as if just a general film enthusiast, I thought it was pretty well done. And just thinking about how they shot it and how those people had to spend so much time up on that ski lift, the actors and the actress, really was great. But from a just moviegoer, it really was kind of slow. And I thought that, you know.
Well, let me break it down for you. The reason why it was a great movie was because, and here's the list. Number one, it was actually had a pacing that didn't, you know, require you to take some kind of medication in case the strobing effect of all the editing, you know, in the film caused you to go into, you know, some kind of seizure. Because I love the fact that it was classically shot. Classically edited, number one.
Yes.
Number two, I love the fact that they kind of set the characters up. They didn't get right into it. They at least were smart enough to give us some sense of foreshadowing, because from the very first shots where you see those cables like close up cranking and they're kind of, you know, the sound effect is very intense and it's really ominous. It's setting us up that this isn't like just some hunky-dory, you know, light story. But at the same time, for the next 10, 15 minutes or whatever, we're just seeing, it was like, you know, an episode of Dawson's Creek. I mean, it was seriously honestly, at that point I was like, yeah, this isn't,
is this going to go anywhere? Yeah.
This isn't really emotional for me. And so as we're going through, you know, I'm like, okay, but then that moment when they're, and I'm okay, minor spoiler alert, when they're, it's at night, they're on the ski lift, the thing is stuck and it's gotten stuck earlier, and they're just kind of going back and forth, and those lights start going out behind them, and then they're in complete darkness.
That was actually the one part of the movie that I really liked.
Yeah. It was, I think what I just appreciated is it was very well paced. It was Hitchcockian. It was well paced. It was suspenseful. The characters were dealing with nothing was ever so over the top or ridiculous. I never felt one time that a character did something and I was like, well, why would you do that? Because I remember after the movie, like days afterwards, I kept thinking, well, what if they had just, like, no, that probably wouldn't have worked. They'd have gotten, then fill in the blank of what happens to them. It gets pretty grisly pretty fast. But even then, in hindsight, it wasn't as graphic as I think it could have been, especially for a few of those parts.
Oh, definitely.
But it's definitely bloody. I mean, if, you know, you're into effects, you're into gore. I mean, there's some blood in this movie. But
yeah, but it wasn't like you and I have talked about. It wasn't. It didn't go to the point of torture porn or
it
was just enough, I think. Yeah.
Well, and I think, and again, I go back to this idea that it's not so much that you have gore or violence in a movie. It's the way it's presented and the way the characters that it happens to are presented. And I think that if the filmmaker gives across this idea of these are characters that they truly care about, that they, and that comes across in the film itself. And then even if something really horrific happens to that character, you feel that. And that's okay. I have a problem when it's almost done flippantly, when it's done like just purely as an exercise in let's watch a human being suffer. And I don't dig that. And I know some people do. They're a cup of tea. Fine for them. For me, I don't. But in a movie like Frozen, that totally obviously is not remotely what's going on. Although these characters do suffer. I mean, there's definitely suffering going on, but you care about them. And I like that. So I care about people. Jason doesn't. That's what I've gotten from this conversation.
Yes, I care nothing. I hate people.
Okay, well, then let me throw out the other movie that actually perfectly marries onto this one. And by the way, folks, before you go, well, for love of God, they're just talking about new movies. You know, these aren't. But the show is called Forgotten Flicks. And as far as I'm concerned, the two movies we're talking about didn't light up the box office. And for instance, Frozen, other than the show DVD Geeks I listened to, I had never even heard of it. And Buried, I had heard of. I know it did pretty well on the film festival circuit and everything. But again, really ultra low budget indie, didn't get a whole lot of mainstream attention. So as far as I'm concerned, the Forgotten piece applies to the mainstream. So
plus it gives you some context of why we think the way we think, which is scary in general.
God almighty. You don't want to go too deep in there, folks.
No.
Yeah, make sure you wear your hip waders. Buried, I watched pretty much. Hold on one second. Could you hear that?
Was that a good sound?
And the reason why I had a problem with it, I want to start with you, what we like to call the, some people call it the butt sandwich around here, folks. We call it the poop sandwich.
We call it the poop sandwich, yeah.
No. Ryan Reynolds did a fantastic job. Great actor. Okay. I am highly impressed that they managed to keep, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, the entire running time of this movie takes place in a coffin. the whole movie.
And don't give it away.
Oh God, did I just ruin it? But honestly, that was amazing. I mean, because you actually are engaged. My problem with it lies in the fact, and I can't really say too much without giving away some pretty major plot points, but it's enough to say that the choices certain characters make, because he has a cell phone, I don't think that's any big secret. If you see the trailer, I think they make reference to it. Yeah. And obviously he has to have a way to communicate with people. I think they were just so desperate to create drama because he's in a box for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Some of the things he's doing, I'm like, really, dude?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
That's how you're going to try and stop that thing from really? That's how you're going to respond? Why? And you get to a certain point where you'll accept one or two of those, but then by the end, you really feel like, okay, so let me get this straight. This character told him this at the beginning of the movie. Pretty much was a lie, but then at the very end, it all connects back. I mean, honestly, I didn't want to think that hard. It was late, and I was like, man, I'm done. So for me, Buried was what I guess Frozen was for you. Now, although I did not find it boring, I mean, to be fair, I did not find it boring, but I just found it to be a letdown from the perspective of the character motivations and choices that you know happened throughout the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So be sure
and,
you
and,
see
and
that
you
one.
And you and I have definitely talked about this, that if there is some kind of – if you're not being emotionally true, or if there's something that really seems out of whack with the character, that tends to be more of a put off than if there are technical errors sound. Or film errors. It just, if you can't connect on that real humanistic level and there's some kind of dishonesty, then that's what really, I think, kills it.
I will say, from a technical perspective, the only one that you have to be extraordinarily careful about is sound, because it's pretty much been proven that people will watch a crappy picture with fantastic sound and they'll at least muddle through. And again, I have a case in point on that one, just to hold that thought. But they will not do the reverse. If the sound is going in and out or up and down, and it's very just, and it's not on purpose. This is like just a really badly done sound editing job or sound design. But the visuals are Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago. We're talking David Lean, beautiful people. Well, and it happens. Think about how many times have you watched a movie? Have you ever had this experience where maybe the connection was bad or something, and you get that, like the sound is dropping in and out and out. The picture's fine. I can't watch it. I can't watch it. However, the reverse is not true, and I can prove it because this probably will apply more to the gentlemen in the audience, and gentlemen 30s through their 40s more so. But rewind back, it's about 1980 or whatever, and cable boxes back then, folks, scramble channels, but usually only the visuals and usually only a little bit. And let's just say hypothetically that some of those channels showed, I don't know, a certain type of entertainment. Okay?
Male entertainment, generally.
Yeah, usually. Well, I guess if that's what you were into, dude, whatever. I have an open mind, brother. It's all good.
Hey, never.
So what the point is that the you could hear things just fine, and I really don't remember that being a big deterrent that, everything was scrambled. And so that was a pretty crappy picture. So that being said, that's my anecdotal evidence to prove my point.
In that one case, I will say, great picture. Who cares?
Yes, yes. Well, and usually even then, if you kind of like adjusted things,
if you switch back and forth on the channel real fast.
If you kind of, you were messing with the knobs and,
Hey, this is a no explicit tag on this show.
Really? Maybe we should start adding them. So anyway. So those are the two movies, and in thanks to Red K Queen on Twitter, so follow her at Red K Queen. Her first name is Tawana. She gave us a fantastic idea. She said we should start doing like a survey type thing on the blog, and I probably eventually will do this, called Flix It or Forget It. And I thought that was so friggin' catchy, it's ridiculous. So, for purposes, and like as if you couldn't guess from the rants we just went on, Jason, Frozen, Flix It or Forget It?
I'm going to have to say Forget It on Frozen.
Wow, I'm shocked to hear that.
Yeah, I know. Surprise.
I would say Flix It.
Yeah, well.
So top of the queue, buddy. Top of the queue. And for Buried, since you didn't see it, I'll throw it out there. Forget it, because I would say kind of somewhere in the middle, because it's interesting. If you're a filmmaker, it's an interesting exercise to see them do what they did with such little resources, so few resources. But forget it if you pretty much want to have a story where you're not going to want to, like, punch the TV because the character yeah. does things and you're like, why would you do that? So anyway, so for that, for me, I would say for most people, forget it. But maybe a handful of folks flicks it.
2 a.m. You got nothing else to do. Yeah.
Other than, you know, try to look at scrambled channels, which unfortunately, see, the kids today, it was the Patton Oswalt, I think, did a bit about that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
about the,
yes.
kid, the kids today, the good old days and how they, you know, can't, you yeah. know, get they pretty much, you know, don't get to masturbate to squiggly lines anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Porn's way too accessible.
Yeah. Way too. God, there's no challenge. It's just boring. No. So anyway, on that note.
On that note, let's.
We'll now go into our family segment. The Night
Hello,
of the Comet special.
How are you? Yeah.
Hello, little children.
Welcome. Welcome to Night of the Comet.
Welcome to Night of the Comet.
Did you ever wonder what it would be like to be one of the last people on Earth?
We're talking ghost town!
Who would you see?
There's nobody. I mean, there's nobody.
What would you do?
Hey, I'm sorry if the end of the world makes me a little nervous.
Where would you go?
The stars are up ahead!
Well, get ready to find out, because the comet is coming into your orbit.
The legal drinking age is now 10, but... You will need ID. Let's be real.
It's the Night of the Comet.
What do you give me if I come back?
Texas?
Night of the Comet.
I'll be taking requests from all you teenage comet zombies.
The night the teenagers ruled the world.
Yeah!
Night of the Comet.
The burden of civilization is on us.
Fiction, isn't it?
So, anyway,
the movie. Let's shift gears.
Just go right into it, man. You first.
obviously, we had a phenomenal interview with Kelly Maroney last week,
yep.
and this really all started from you and I having a conversation about this movie and how we both kind of, as kids, remembered really being fond of this movie. It's kind of being this horror sci-fi blend, and we both really liked it as kids, and we watched it, and then. We decide, hey, let's do an episode about it, and then that's kind of what sparked your. You also rated it one of your top movies from 1984, and
yep.
Kelly Maroney responded, which led to this phenomenal interview. Which actually, we watched it again before we talked to her, and I liked it, and I'll kind of give him my thoughts on it. But then after even talking to her, I went back and watched it again, and I got even more of an appreciation for it because some of the stuff she said really, I think, added. To the movie. I mean, some of the stuff that she gave us about the fact that her character was supposed to die and mm-hmm. that they tried to get a nude scene in there. And
don't forget the underwear.
Don't forget the underwear. But it was just it was a great movie. Actually, the brief synopsis is that this comet is supposed to come really close to Earth. And so it's on every news channel and everybody's going to go out to see it. And they kind of have this set up scenes of the two main characters, Regina and Samantha, who are two sisters, whose dad, I guess, is in the military or –
Yeah, I think he's supposed to be like a special forces guy.
Yeah, yeah. And then
like
their stepmom – their stepmom is the one that's kind of watching them pseudo, and then they're both high school age. I think Regina, who is played by Catherine Mary Stewart, is the senior
yeah.
and – Her younger sister Kelly,
her 15-ish.
Is like, yeah, like I don't know, freshman, sophomore, maybe junior. But so anyway, the two of them survive because what happens is the comet passes so close to Earth that if you are protected by some kind of metal casing or if you're protected by some kind of shielding, you're safe. But if you're out in the open, you're pretty much reverted to pink. Dust.
And apparently that standard is extraordinarily low since Samantha's in a tool shed.
Yes, it has to be microscopically thin metal.
Yes. That's, aluminum.
If you're near it.
Yeah. Tool shed is fine.
Yes, sleeping yes. in the tool shed. And her older sister is, you know, knocking boots up in a, you know, up in a
if this
camera.
If this projection booth's a rocking,
yeah,
don't
exactly.
come a knocking.
Projection booth, you know, $15. Come on. So basically, there are two types of people that you know, they experience. One is the people who are basically piles of dust and have been completely obliterated, or the pseudo-zombies, not really zombies in the classic sense, but more people who have been exposed to too much radiation. They experience one in the beginning who is the most zombie-like, this kind of, I guess, homeless guy who is chewing on Regina's boyfriend.
Continue.
Okay. So Regina. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not chewing on him that way. Chewing on his chews on his liver, and then Samantha comes across him and, you know, escapes. Samantha.
She kicks his ass.
Yeah. Regina kicks his ass.
Regina kicks his ass.
And then takes off on a motorcycle. But so it's not really, which
wait,
I thought.
Wait, Jason. Yeah. Just occurred to me. Do you think there was a racial component to that part?
You know, he was.
Nah, dude, I'm totally kidding.
No.
Just
kidding. No, because the baddest people in this were definitely all very white.
Yeah, they were stock boys.
Yeah. So, yes, they were stock boys in a.
Ooh, stock. Wait, here we go. I got the connection. Stock boys. It's the mid 80s. You know, Wall Street is starting to kind of really kick into high gear. You got movie, obviously, a few years later, you're going to have the movie Wall Street. A couple years before this, you had Trading. Well, actually, 1 year before this, you had Trading Places, right, which obviously dealt with, you know, Wall Street and everything. So they were stock boys, yes, but metaphorically, they were stock boys. Get it? And so, therefore, they were evil. I'm just totally kidding. The meds have worn off, folks.
You are
pulling
this out of your left ass.
That is better than what I was going to get into, which was it's the 80s, so why didn't they just try and snort the dust?
Which I'm surprised that somebody hasn't.
I'm really surprised that wasn't like a scene in the movie. Come on, let's just give it a shot, Regina. What do we got to lose?
Anyway, the long and short of it is they're survivors. They're trying to find other survivors, avoid zombies, and then they come across these My son watched this movie with me, and he calls them the Maze People or the Maze Team. There are these underground lab who apparently knew this was going to happen, and they're trying to find ways to survive and save the race. But their logo looks like a little maze, like one of those little handheld.
Well, may I inject this part?
Yes, please.
Something I read for all you Lost fans out there. I love this idea. I don't give a crap whether it's true or not. We're going to pretend it is, okay? The theory was, if you really pay attention to that whole dynamic, that think tank, their logo and the jumpsuits they wear, everything about them screamed Dharma Initiative, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so I got to believe in my heart of hearts that J.J. Abrams, Carlton Cuse, Damon Lindelof, somebody from Lost loved them some Night of the Comet. This seems like a movie that they would have been aware of.
At the very least. The wardrobe of the jumpsuits.
Oh, yeah. But you think about it. Think about how all the Dharma Initiative, obviously, because of the time period the Dharma Initiative takes place, all of their equipment, you know, is that very late 70s, early 80s look and feel, which, of course, this movie takes place then. So it makes sense that all the equipment looks that way. But the logo, you know, it had that very Dharma. I know the Dharma Initiative
Octagon,
logo.
Yeah,
we talked about that before. It was actually derived from the, what was it? Refresh my memory.
It's a Taoist symbol.
Yes. But this had that vibe. And if even in the scenes where if you pay attention to like the food and stuff that's behind them, that just has like the white label and says like, you know, beer. And it just it just had everything about it screamed Dharma Initiative.
I'm just waiting for one of the guys to walk out with a jumpsuit that says Workman.
Yes, Workman. And I will tell you what, how much more awesome would the ending of Lost have been? Mild spoiler alert, folks. If in fact it turned out that somehow the Dharma Initiative, in fact, that was a Dharma Initiative, and that entire world, that like parallel universe, is what essentially instigated everything that would have been, from a mythological standpoint, far more satisfying.
I got to tell you, there probably would have been a riot if all of Lost was based on the movie The Night of the Comets.
More like a quiet riot, because I think that would have been profoundly awesome. If they could have figured out some way to tie that in, I would have loved that.
I'd have been happy.
Yeah, I would have dealt with it. But anyway, go ahead. I might have interrupted you. I apologize. Continue.
What was I talking about? Huh? Oh, yeah. And so they survive. No spoiler alert that they survive. And along the way, they meet up with another survivor. And so the three of them, Regina, Samantha and their newfound beau Hector,
yes,
survive and kind of go through the trials of these lab people trying to get them and the zombies trying to get them and them trying to survive in a world with almost everybody gone.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the synopsis in general. My feeling of it was I really like this movie. I like it now. I loved it then when I was a kid. Obviously, we talked about the nostalgia syndrome, inflated nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But I really liked it now, and to the extent that, you know, like I said, my daughter really liked it. Even my wife liked it, who does not like the movies I like. Like I said, eclectic mix. I tend to have some campy fever at times, but she really did like it. And I think one of the things I loved about this movie was it felt like it was very focused on the three characters. It didn't get too caught up on what was going on in the world. I mean, we think about a lot of like these big zombie movies, these big world apocalypse movies. They try and show what's going on in Russia and what's going on in China and what's going, you know, they just focused on these two characters, these sisters trying to survive in LA where they lived, and just the little things that went on in their life. They didn't get bigger. They didn't show this big newsreel. They didn't try and show. They just focused on these folks. Now, you could probably take that as this made it feel low budget, but I took it as really it was just these two girls and their experience and everything that was going on. And I think that made it really, really work.
Well,
so
I also think that you have to consider the fact that it plays that way is because it's so low budget. They didn't have the budget to expand it. However, in kind of a classic scenario, that works in its favor because, your point, it would have been a lot easier, obviously, but it would have been, to increase the scope of it, do it like an Independence Day type of deal and have it be much, much bigger and have this huge cast of characters. But
Armageddon, you know.
Yeah, which obviously were movies that came out substantially later, but still, that's that type of disaster movie sort of, where we have like a cast of, a dozen people that we follow through the movie. But I also come back to, a lot of times if you can hone it in on just one or two main characters like that, you allow the audience to connect with them on a deeper level than if you have to kind of split the story out over a dozen different characters.
Yeah,
I agree with you. I think I like that. I think another thing I liked about it is, and this was touched upon in the Maroney interview, it really and truly, if you want to see a movie that just feels like the 80s in a good way, it just feels right, that movie is it, because just the movie theater scene, just the way the city looks, the red tinting to the sky, just everything about it.
Mall scene, definitely.
Mall scene, all that has a very, just in the same way that Dawn of the Dead, the original Dawn of the Dead, when they're in the mall and everything, just has that 70s, like late 70s, very early 80s vibe to it. This movie has that more mid 80s vibe to it, and I like that. I thought it was very cool. And the other thing I've noticed, and I know I cannot be remotely the only person that's picked up on this, but it's always not jarring. Jarring sounds like it's bad, but it always strikes me that
startling.
No, not startling, because it still sounds like, oh my God. but it strikes me as interesting that whenever I watch a film from that time period, it's not that the clothes and the hair and everything's dated. It's how real people look. Like, I think when I watch a movie now, everybody is too groomed, which is for a good pun considering who you are. But if you know what I'm saying, like they just seem too perfect. We could get into the whole issue of these nubile starlets that get plastic surgery from the age of 12. I mean, that's a whole other issue. But
I see what you mean. I mean, I think you're saying, I've seen it in a lot of, obviously any of the more contemporary movies. You see a lot of they strive for so much reality that it seems fake.
It's like hyper real.
It's kind of like Clue, Intron, too real.
No. Actually, no. He just looked like a frigging cartoon character.
No, he just did. Yeah. I agree with you. And it's something in, I think part of it is something in the filming of it. Because you and I have talked about in the past that sometimes filming something in that old style gives it a lot different of a flavor. So it's not just about you know, the storyline. It's also about the look of it and the feel of it, I think, is a little bit different.
Well, and actually, it's interesting you bring that point up, because I don't know if it'd even remotely be possible to try and duplicate it digitally, you know, using some type of program and post. But the fact of the matter is, a good friend of mine shot lots and lots of film. Back in the day, he owned a 16-millimeter camera, and we got talking one time about what is it that kind of can create that? Why is it, like, you look at E.T.,
right, and it's
the aesthetic of it is so different than, you know, certain films that came out 10, 15 years later.
Yeah.
A lot of it actually comes down to the chemical makeup of the film stock from that time period, because apparently it changed periodically, and literally the chemical compounds and the way the light reacts to them, or they react to light, I should say, all of that worked in concert to create that feel and that look, and whether the blacks and the contrast was deeper, and, you know, that kind of thing. So, and then of course you get the whole issue of, you know, who the DP was. But I'm not even talking about, I mean, I know you're talking about as far as the aesthetic of the film. I'm talking about the look of the people, the hair. Let's just go with the hair.
Okay.
Not just the girl hair that's always the big mall hair, but like the guys, that sort of, you know what I'm talking about, that feathered sort of light. It's not over, you know, produced. It's not over stylized. It just kind of flops
back down
there.
Like a little bit less than Michael J. Fox, but, you know, not quite down to the level of Johnny Depp, 21 Jump. Like the fixer watch.
Well, you know, it's sort of like they, you know, like if a guy's got kind of a greasy mullet, he could be the friggin' star of the movie, and they still kind of leave it looking like a greasy mullet. And I find that there's something about that I actually kind of find endearing. I like that, you know, whenever there were like a woman was a character in the movie, that occasionally, you know, she wasn't built like a porn star. You know, she looked like a real woman, you know, and I like that authenticity. I feel like sometimes, like, I watch that and it's like I'm getting this like visual equivalent of a drink, you know, that I was just dying of thirst and I didn't even realize it, of just that realness. And it's amazing how, for me, I find that there's an impact. Like, I literally am like, and it's not like it jars me out of the movie or anything, but it almost like it pulls me in deeper. Like, I feel like these are real friggin' people that I care about. So I get more into the story.
Yeah, and I think with this one of the things I liked was that and again, you know, if you haven't seen it, you got to go see it. I guess you got to rent it and stay and see it. But
yes, same thing.
Point. Anyway, it was one of those movies that it definitely has moments that are a little campy or a little cheesy, but the characters in them, I thought, did feel more real. And we talked to Kelly about this, and my favorite moment in the movie was when Regina was out in the street and said, you know, here's Chuck. And she dumps out the shoe full of dust. And Kelly Maroney's character, Samantha, just kind of turns around, closes the door gently. But she played it so real. It did. They both felt like real individuals, you know. And so it was, again, 80s contrast, a little bit of, you know, you got to understand the context of the movie. But it did work out really well. So I watched it a couple of times in the last month, and two times in the last month, and it really did work out well, and I liked it. Like I said, held hold up really well for, what is it, 20 good grief
27
30 years. I was gonna say it's almost 30 years.
Yep.
Wow.
So. And the fact is that, you know, my favorite scene, of course, involved underwear. And even though her character is supposed to be the issue, not creepy, because the actress was in her 20s at the time. So
it is. Seriousness, I said, you were how old in 1984? You know, you were.
Yes, but
a teenager,
that
works.
I was not a teenager in 1984, you smart ass.
You were 9 or 10.
Yes, as I pointed out. I think that one of my favorite scenes was actually the scene on the car that they have, the two sisters have together. And I think that was what was interesting. I liked that they looked nothing alike. I mean, they did not look like sisters. Like, if they played it as they were half sisters, maybe I could have bought it a little better from a physical perspective, but there was a good connection there. I felt like they had history.
They acted like sisters.
And actually, I take it back. My very favorite scene is probably when they're shooting up the one car, and then Samantha turns to Regina and says, "Daddy would have gotten us Uzis, because that's just friggin' awesome."
And she walks off.
And she walks off.
Yeah, that was perfect.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to love about the movie. And for full disclosure, honestly, I had every intention of watching it again, and I just never got the opportunity.
Slacker.
Yeah, you're right. I have nothing else that's going on. And I was a little annoyed. I was just contemplating just kind of just putting it in and fast forwarding through parts. I was like, oh, and it's funny, but just having watched it the, you know, little time before we did the Kelly interview, I felt like it still has stuck with me. Like I still remember it. And it was,
oh, definitely.
It was funny that there were the scenes that I thought transpired a certain way from the last time I'd seen it before that, which was like, you know, 5 or 6 years prior.
Yeah.
Didn't they still, it was almost like there were certain moments that were kind of fresh. And I'm sorry, little side, you know, road to go down here because it does relate to the movie though, is that little kid, little zombie kid thing that freaked me out. I don't know what it was about him. I don't know if it was just the way he came at Hector.
Yeah,
that crap, I don't know, something about that man, it always freaks me out.
It was his eyes or
yeah,
something.
It's like, yeah, you're just gonna, yeah, you know,
I think, you know, the one thing, the last thing I'll say about the movie in general is that I'm glad they didn't go with Teenage Comet Zombies, because it wasn't, to me, a zombie movie. It was more of a survival kind of apocalypse movie, but it didn't focus on the zombies.
Yeah.
And it was, to me, more about the two of them and them surviving in this new normal. And it wasn't about zombies, but I think it's hilarious hearing that he was kind of – that Tom Eberhardt was kind of teed off when he did the – script for it and was just kind of writing something to thumb his nose at Hollywood that had zombies and teenage girls and shopping malls
and comets.
Yeah, and a comet. And even in the movie poster, it's got the two of them holding shopping bags while they're holding their Uzis. But
now that's a DVD cover, because I think the poster, the original poster, I freaking love, which is right at the top is like everybody kind of looking, the crowds looking up at the comet, and then that doorway. And it's like Regina standing in the doorway and just kind of in silhouette. Yeah, I love that. I want to get that poster and hang it in my cube.
I'll put it up in the projection booth for you.
Yeah.
But so I'm glad it didn't turn out to be called a zombie movie, but it was cool. Held up for me.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not we had Kelly Maroney as an interview, we both talked about.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
It worked out well.
Yeah, it was a pleasant surprise, because it was one of those movies from my youth that I felt held up, and maybe even more so, like I appreciated it on a different level than I did as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, as a kid, obviously it pretty much was guns, zombies, and underwear for me. But on this, as an adult, it was still all of those things, but it was also, I just could appreciate, you know, little things like, yeah, even though I know Kelly said that LA is, you know, really can be dead at certain times, it still struck me as interesting that they were able to get that, you know, to pull that off, because it's really hard.
Oh yeah,
to create the illusion of you're the only ones left on the planet, especially in a city like LA.
Yeah, and both of you and I both come from, you know, relatively smaller cities, and well, relatively a lot smaller cities than LA.
Yeah.
And so our perspective of things like Chicago and New York City and LA is that they're just 24/7 bustling cities.
Well, golly, what are you talking about?
Look at that big skyscrapers. Holy cow.
Well, golly, dear Wilkers, yeah, we're going to the big city.
So to see them empty, I mean, as a kid, I thought, oh my God, how did they build a backlot that big? And then as an adult, I thought, Jesus, how did they shoot with no people around?
Oh, bullcrap, you told me the same thing. As an adult, you said, God, how'd they build a backlot that big?
Yeah.
It's like, Jason, that was
they
a city.
They built skyscrapers out of cardboard.
Jason, leave the trailer and go to the city. It exists, Jason. It's not just some big conspiracy.
Don't knock on my trailer park now.
Nothing wrong if you work in a trailer park. Jeez, I can't even talk. Nothing. No offense if you live in one.
No, not at all.
My dad lives in one.
My in-law. So. Hey, wait.
Of course, that doesn't really, I don't know, does that even count? Because that's like an, you know, one of those, I almost said old fart parks. Sorry, Dad.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
My dad's going to kick my ass.
Okay, just lost one third of our audience.
Yeah,
now.
My dad, gone. You're great. One third of the audience, great. My dad's gone.
Oh, we have just ran down the rabbit trail.
Well, of course we did. But I would also like to point out that since you brought up L.A. and that the scope of the movie, total friggin' digression, and I don't give a damn. Have you seen the trailer, the new trailer, for Battle Los Angeles?
Ooh, no.
Dude, go on. I have a feeling this movie is going to completely and utterly let me down. And the trailer really gives no indication of a story. I don't give a crap. If the entire movie is that creepy electronica song playing with the crap that's happening in the trailer for an hour and a half, 2 hours, I am dope. I'm good. I am ready to. I am ready to show up front and center opening day, March 11th.
Listen, sometimes you just have to appreciate a trailer, just for the trailer.
Yeah, the last time I did it was a movie called Species. I don't know if you've seen it, where the trailer was really good, and I'm like, oh my god, look at this movie.
Separate the two. Wait.
Forrest Whitaker is in this movie. Holy crap, he's awesome. Ben Kingsley. Oh my freaking god, dude. Gandhi. He's in this movie. So I'm thinking, wow. Oh, Michael Madsen. I love me Michael Madsen, dude. He was Mr. White in friggin' Reservoir Dogs. Stuck in the middle with you. I love everything about this movie. Mark Helgenberger's in it. This is before.
Are you saying this movie wasn't awesome?
Dude. Okay, I understand that Natasha, whatever her name is. And a very attractive young lady, and was basically disrobed throughout like 80% of the movie. And on that level, I could appreciate it, but the movie was awful. And the moment I remember it was awful is when Forrest Whitaker's character, the psychic, have you noticed something too? I don't hate movies because they're necessarily bad. I hate them when they just completely and totally treat me or any audience member like you're an idiot. So when he comes in and there is like a train and mild spoiler alert if you haven't seen Species, sorry about that. So there's this train and she's cocooned and come out of her cocoon and now she's like hot Natasha Henstridge, which is her name. I just remembered it. And yeah, she went from being Jen, also known as Michelle Williams, just a quick trivia note, and I'm totally pulling this out of my head. Michelle Williams is the little girl version of the alien chick, which, what is her name? It's on the tip of my tongue. I know H.R. Geiger designed it.
I have no idea.
Okay, anyway.
I've blocked that movie out of my memory.
But Michelle Williams, you know, ended up being married to Heath Ledger and played Jen on Dawson's Creek. Yes, I watched Dawson's Creek. Don't judge me. So, wow, that just completely killed any if there was even just a tiny modicum of respect anybody had for me, it just went like a bye-bye.
No, none.
No, what am I saying? Nobody had respect to begin with. I get no respect. So, anyway, so Michelle Williams is the little, you know, she turns into Natasha Henstridge via a big, meaty, bloody cocoon. And she's gone and like this, you know, some kind of conductor or somebody's laying there dead in the train. And they come on board the train. There's flies around. It's stank because people are holding them. They're
blood. And there's blood, this gore dripping from the walls.
And so, so the psychic walks in
Forrest
and goes,
says,
does one of those like kind of like the Joey Tribbiani school of acting where you smell a fart and you... And you just kind of look around the room.
Turn your head a little, very deep.
Yeah.
And he says,
something bad has happened here. Dude, I went, are you flipping? What the hell?
No shit, Sherlock.
I was like, A-roop-a-roo. Oh my God.
I don't think it was meant to be a
intellectual
movie or
ass. What it was, your movie can be campy, it can be fun, it can be goofy, it can just be flat out stupid. But Dumb and Dumber did not insult my intelligence, okay? Because they sort of set up the characters as being, dumb. So I can accept when they said they did some really dumb stuff. And by the way, folks, I like Dumb and Dumber. Jason doesn't. Ooh, let's open up that can of worms, shall we? No. In all seriousness, back to Species.
Back trailers.
Hold on. Back to Species. Wait, no, back to Battle Los Angeles. So Battle Los Angeles. In a nutshell, it's Independence Day minus the cheese and the 30 minutes of unnecessary subplot. Of course, I'm assuming that because for all I know, it's just filled with unnecessary subplots. But my big beef with Independence
Day looks good. Yes. Your point.
Independence Day is one of those movies that I find extraordinarily entertaining, except there's like 30 minutes of too much story, which is a constant problem in Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin movies. And pretty much Godzilla was an entirely, full length version of that. But all of their movies. So it's like Stargate. Fantastic. Wait, I'm watching this for the third time. Why does it seem so long? Oh, because it's got like 30 minutes of too much stuff in it. So, that being said, it's Independence Day minus the sort of the corniness is what it looked like. It looked very like this very realistic kind of raw action movie, but with flipping like aliens and robots and stuff.
I like aliens.
Aaron Eckhart is in it. He's a fantastic actor. Oh, my God. Oh, Sign. Oh, Michelle Rodriguez. Anna Lucia is in it. Oh, dude. I'm so there. So there.
Okay, so on that note,
since we're pushing an hour now.
I was going to say, should we at any point get into our six?
Yes, I think we should, and we probably want to expedite them because I'm losing all feeling in my lower torso from having stood here for so long. Okay, so and on that note, we will now do our...
Early. Wait, where's your kazoo? I'm waiting for
kazoo. Hold on.
It's like Pistons.
Now for our six movies you must see featuring. That's your part.
Oh, sorry. We're taking a little bit of a different spin.
No, you're supposed to say featuring actors.
Oh, sorry. Featuring actors from Night of the Comet.
Hey. Now, go ahead.
Okay. So we took a little different spin on this. Instead of coming up with six movies that were similar to Night of the Comet or other apocalyptic movies or other movies about comets or asteroids or whatever, we decided since we featured Kelly Maroney last week, two weeks ago, last episode, that we would this time talk about movies from actors from or actresses
well,
from.
Actors and one director.
Yes, and director. Or people from Night of the Comet.
People involved with the production. The Grip. Actually, we may have covered one of their movies. We should have done that. We should have done like The Grip and like the Gaffer and The Best Boy. We should have done like that, all of their movies.
Second assistant editors.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
We should have totally done that.
So, and whatever.
Next time. Go ahead.
Anyway. So my first one, I'm starting with the star of Night of the Comet, Catherine Mary Stewart, who also starred in.
You mean Kelly Maroney?
Top billing on the credits, who is Catherine Mary Stewart, who played Regina in the Night of the Comet, was the older sister. She also played in one of my favorite movies as a kid, which was The Last Starfighter from 1984. I love that this movie. I haven't seen it real recently. It's been probably about 10 years or so. It's in my queue. But I absolutely loved it as a kid. It's as we talked about in the Tron movie, one of those fantasies of mine. I'm playing a video game. You beat the video game, and an alien race comes down and says, "You have just become the hero."
It's Centauri, my boy.
Yeah. So it's this amazing story about this kid. Alex, who's played by Lance Guest, who is most known for his TV stuff. But
oh, no. He's most known for Jaws, The Revenge.
The Revenge and Halloween 2.
Oh, yeah. No, he wasn't Halloween 2. He's told, if you think about it, he's Jamie Lloyd's dad. For all you Halloween fans, go ahead, Jason. Sorry. God, this is the later we do this crap.
I know. But anyway, it's we really need to do this in the morning.
Yeah, we should do this at like 8:30 a.m. Oh, God. I'm good now.
No, let's talk.
Let's stay focused on the subject at all times.
Then we would have 1.5 listeners. So the story is basically this guy lives in a trailer park. At the office trailer park, there's this one stand-up arcade game, Starfighter, and he plays it incessantly, obsessively, and he beats it to the throngs of cheering crowds standing around him who happen to be the other trailer park inhabitants. And later on he gets a visit from an alien who says he has now been chosen as a real hero. He thinks it's all part of the video game, that he's been chosen as some kind of a, you know, winner. But it's a really cool story. Catherine Mary Stewart plays his girlfriend Maggie, who most of her stuff, is played with both Alex and with Beta Alex, who's kind of his clone.
Yeah, be careful. Spoilers.
I know. I don't want to give it too much.
If you haven't seen Starfighter, for love of God.
But it's an awesome movie. It's basically, like I said, story of a video gamer who becomes, universal hero. But fantastic movie. And Catherine Mary Stewart, this is the movie I saw her in first. I didn't see Night of the Comet until after this. And this is the one I actually like her in more.
Say with me, kids.
She's the girlfriend you wish you had in high school.
but didn't.
No. But it also stars Dan, I think it's O'Herlihy.
O'Herlihy. Yeah.
He's the guy who was the old man in RoboCop. He was the head of the company. And
oh, was he really?
Yes. He was the bad guy in RoboCop. But in this, he's got all this makeup on that he's his alien friend Grig, but he also plays the old man in RoboCop. So,
oh, dude. Yeah, I know it's not completely forgotten. I don't give a damn. We are still going to do a RoboCop episode. Yeah.
God, can I pause for a second? Did I just stump you on something movie related?
You totally did.
Didn't know that.
But is that the extent of your trivia for this movie?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay, well, I have a connection bringing it right back. This is not, in fact, this is a connection between Lance Guest, the star of Last Starfighter, and the director of The Last Starfighter, because Lance Guest was in Halloween 2. The director, Nick Castle.
Nick Castle, yep.
Who was he? Jason?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was actually going to give you the opportunity.
Okay, drum roll.
No, I was actually giving you the opportunity to fill in the blank, but I guess I will if you don't know. I'll do that really obnoxious. Well, never mind.
Well, if you don't know, I'm not telling you.
I thought everybody knew. Like, you can't just go on IMDb and look up Nick Castle credits. Nick Castle is the original Shape. He played Michael Myers in the original. Mike Myers, yeah. Yeah, baby. He played Michael Myers in the original Halloween. So he ended up directing The Last Starfighter with Lance Guest, who was in Halloween 2.
Yeah, not so much.
Oh, I thought it was impressive. Anyway, so, okay, on that note.
Anyway, that was my Catherine Mary story.
All right, cool. All right, well, I will now go into my first pick, which I guess we put as at number 5. It's going to be Salem's Lot, the TV movie from 1979. I chose this because Mr. Jeffrey Lewis was in it, and Jeffrey Lewis actually kind of in Night of the Comet, he plays, and why am I brain farting on his name? Oh, Carter is what, yeah, I had it written down, but honestly, I would never remember that anyway. Carter, which doesn't really matter because did they even call him that at any point? I guess they must have, but I don't recall it. Yeah, anyway, he's sort of the head honcho of the think tank, the little Dharma Initiative guys.
The lab rats.
Yeah, but he's a great actor. He's been tons of stuff. He was in another really kind of obscure-ish movie that nobody saw called Way of the Gun that was written by and directed by the guy who did Usual Suspects, whose name is also escaping at the moment because it's late. And but yeah, he's a great actor. He's been in tons of stuff, but he was in that original Salem's Lot movie in 1979. He played Mike Ryerson. Wasn't a huge part, but it was kind of a mini series. And interesting about that movie is that it starred David Soul. Anybody remember who David Soul is?
No.
Starsky and Hutch.
I never watched that show.
Okay. And also, it was directed. This is probably the part that I am most connected to. And of course, if you don't know, Salem's Lot is based on a Stephen King story. Seriously, hopefully you know that. And it was directed by Toby Hooper. Texas Chainsaw Massacre Hooper, folks. So if you get a chance, check it out. Honestly, the head vampire, friggin' creepy. Just look at the box. He's very much Nosferatu looking. Very cool movie. I'm going to keep it short from that point because obviously we need to expedite things here. But that was my pick. Salem's Lot, the TV movie from 1979 with Jeffrey Lewis.
Can I just add a quick one on Jeffrey Lewis?
Sure.
The one thing that I remember him from, or I guess I should say the two things, are he was in the Clint Eastwood movie, Every Which Way But Loose.
You're right. Yes, he was.
And Any Which Way You Can, the sequel to it, which was
– He was like his buddy, right? Wasn't he like his – was he sidekick or was he –
Brother.
Yeah.
It was his brother, but every time I see him with that disheveled hair, kind of drunken guy.
Yeah, he does have that kind of – yeah, he has that vibe.
And the sideways trucker hat, you know.
And if I'm not mistaken, isn't he Juliette Lewis's dad? In real life, Juliette Lewis, the actress.
Oh, I don't know.
I thought he was, but I could be wrong. I'm sure we'll get the send your hate mail to jason@forgottenflix.com.
Yeah. Mom, send me a hate mail.
Yeah, come on. Well, we know my dad won't. He's already turned this off. So
he turned it off, yeah. But yes, anyway, so the orangutan movie was Clint Eastwood.
Cool. All right, so what is your next pick, number 4 on our list?
So number 4, I went with the love interest in Night of the Comet, who was played by Paul Bartel. He was Hector. He also was in a movie called Eating Raoul. Now, if any of you know Paul Bartel, you also know he was in Star Trek Voyager. He played
in tons of stuff.
He's been a lot of stuff. But he played Chakotay in – was it Chakotay? Was that his name?
I don't remember.
I didn't write it down. Dang it. I know he was in – he was the guy with the face tattoos, and he was kind of Janeway's second in command. And I watched it back in the day, but it's been so long since I've seen it. I've slept since then. But he was in a movie called Eating Raoul, which was kind of a dark comedy, very funny movie. I have actually seen it a long time ago. I caught some clips of it recently to kind of refresh my memory. But basically, he and his wife very not Paul Bartel. God, I just totally just brain farted.
You're talking about Mary Warrenoff?
No, I meant
– She plays his wife in it.
Yeah, Mary Warrenoff. No, I meant Robert Beltran.
Oh, yes. Who's who are you talking about?
totally.
You go, stupid.
Too stupid. Yeah, so.
Have your Chris Farley moment.
It is. I met Robert Beltran, for those of you who are still listening. Robert Beltran, who plays Hector in Night of the Comet, actually was in Eating Raoul, and so was Mary Warnoff, but I'm using her in a different movie.
Yeah, I know.
Regardless. Anyway, it's a dark comedy. It's basically this couple who's very conservative accidentally kills the swinger
Who
comes to a swinger party in the apartment complex they live in, accidentally goes into their apartment, thinks that the wife is part of the swinger deal, starts to, you know, get frisky.
Swing.
The husband comes in, sees
it. Swing
it,
baby.
Hits him with a frying pan. They accidentally kill him and realize, hey, we can make money by killing these swingers and taking their money. And and Robert Beltran comes in later to get a cut on the action and kind of get into it. It's kind of a dark comedy. It's very classic 80s, early 80s movie. It's
82, I think, right?
Yeah, 82. And Mary Warnoff, who's also in Night of the Comet, is also in it. Which is kind of my tie-in. She plays the wife, but
I've got a tie-in for you. Wait till we hit number one.
But you know, Robert Beltran plays in it, and as he self-describes in the movie, calls himself, and I quote, "a hot-blooded, emotional, crazy Chicano." So he's actually over the top in this. He's very good. He's funny. He shows a side that you don't see in Night of the Comet or in Star Trek Voyager. So that was kind of my pick for him. It's a little obscure, but if you're a film buff, you'll have definitely heard of it.
So just for clarity's sake, Robert Beltran was in Star Trek Voyager, not Paul Bartel, right? Because now that you say that, it's like, wait a minute. I thought Paul Bartel – was Mary Warnoff on Star Trek? No.
I should know better than to put my notes in my own handwriting.
Yeah, you really should. Okay, so on that note, I will do the next pick. This would be number 3 on the list. It is The Night Before, starring Keanu Reeves and the lovely Miss Lori Loughlin. It is from 1988, and I chose this because it was directed by none other than Night of the Comet's own Tom Eberhardt, who directed and wrote Night of the Comet. And this actually falls into that category from what we've talked about before, the adventures in babysitting-ish, you know, basically sort of upper crust rich white kids get stuck in the quote-unquote bad part of town. Well, in this one, Lori Loughlin plays a prom queen type, which she does oh so well. And Keanu Reeves actually plays like a complete dork named Winston, who basically her character loses a bet, and she ends up having to go to the prom with him, which leads them to being stuck in this area of town. He gets high as a kite on some kind of drug because his drink was spiked. I'm not giving anything major away, believe me. And it leads to all sorts of shenanigans. Actually, the movie starts with him waking up in an alley, unable to remember anything that happened. And the whole movie is him kind of going back and retracing his steps. And
What happened?
Yeah. Who? I am an FBI agent, dude. Whoa.
Point Break, best movie ever.
Whoa. Excellent. So,
you're blending in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Sorry. Yeah, my bad. But anyway, Night Before.
Except the alley. Doesn't remember anything.
Doesn't remember anything. And it's sort of like all these shenanigans sort of take place. And things involving, I believe, was it Tito the Pimp is one of the characters? And he might end up, say, hypothetically selling Lori Loughlin into said pimpage.
Said Hookeridge.
What was that sound? That was the sound of 1,000 car doors slamming as the cars tore out of the driveway to go to the downtown, I believe it was either LA or Chicago, I don't even remember where the hell it takes place, area.
To look for street workers.
Yes. Look for the Lori Loughlin.
Yes.
Pro.
Not so much.
Yeah, not so much. But yeah, it was, you know, it's a kind of a cheesy movie, but it's a fun movie. And it's reminiscent of Martin Scorsese's After Hours, if you've seen that one. So check it out. The Night Before from 1988. So that was my pick. So Jason, what is your next pick? The number 2. You always get number 2.
I know. That's okay. I like poop sandwiches. So.
Yes, indeed.
I'm good with it.
Yum, 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 yum.
My last one, my number two pick overall, is Mary Warnoff, who plays kind of the lab worker with a conscience out of Night of the Comet. I mean, yes. She's the lady who kind of saves Kelly Maroney by giving her the sodium pentothal, and then
ruin the movie. I'm just kidding.
Sorry. Oh God, Kelly Maroney doesn't die. Oh wait, we kind of gave that away in the interview.
Yeah. Whoopsie.
Anyway, Mary Warnoff, who if you've never heard of her, she's done some great movies. She actually worked with Andy Warhol back in the day, but. Aside from being in Eating Raoul, she was also in a great 70s movie, which was Death Race 2000.
Sweet.
David Carradine, Sylvester Stallone. She actually played Calamity Jane. If you haven't heard of it, even at least heard of reference to it, then you need to climb out of the cave that you're living in, because it's –
dude, you just totally pulled that snotty elitist geek thing where you suddenly are like – you like this obscure-ish thing, and because I'd be like, oh, you haven't seen Death Race. Oh, my God.
Okay.
I'll cut you some slack.
Let me ask you a question. You are calling me an elitist for saying Death Race 2000. Dead in the Closet, Carradine.
No, I'm saying the way you said that was very movie geek elitist. Okay. That's totally different. I'd say because it was Death Race. It could have been anything. You could have been like, oh my, you never saw 1985's Pippi Longstocking? Oh my God, who hasn't seen that?
I have seen that.
Yeah, actually, I've never seen that at the theater.
It is.
She looked like Wendy.
It is an awesome, awesome movie where basically it's this Cannonball Run meets
Death Race.
You get different points for who you run down.
Death Race.
Elderly and the indigent are less points because they can't move as fast.
Death Race.
Death Race.
I'm just going to keep doing that.
It's a hilarious movie.
It's hilarious. Did you say it's a hilarious movie?
Hilarious. I love this movie.
Oh, it's a great movie. I don't know that I'd call it hilarious. I don't think it was meant to be. I mean, it's meant to be a satire, but I don't think it was meant to be like, oh my God, look at that old lady splatter.
See, you were incorrect earlier. I do have one emotion.
Oh,
and
you
that
do.
It's comedy.
Sadism. Yeah, so that was great. No, yeah, it was a very good choice. I agree with that one.
And one last quick thing with this movie is I got to say it stars one of our great, one of our favorite 80s actors. Martin Cove is also in it, who was the bad sensei, who we seem to find a way to weave him into every episode.
The leg.
We need to get him in for an interview. But he was the bad sensei on
The bad sensei. That sounds like a really – that is a script I'm going to write now. The bad sensei. It's like bad Santa.
He was the sensei of Cobra Kai in the original Karate Kid with Ralph Macchio. But he was in this as Nero the Hero and kind of has that same hair. And
Nero the Hero. That's awesome.
He was Nero the Hero. But Sylvester Stallone was in this, and David Carradine was the main.
Of course, it was a Roger Corman joint.
Yes, absolutely. It was definitely meant to be campy. And
I actually have it written down. Paul Bartel has an uncredited cameo in that.
Are you serious?
Yes. They had him down as Frankenstein's doctor. Because Frankenstein was the David Carradine character, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I think it was a bit. It was like a really tiny, quick cameo. But it's interesting how many movies he and Mary Warnoff.
Yeah, really. I've noticed that. Yeah, she really has a long history. But yeah. So anyway, I love the movie. It was awesome. So.
All right, well, then my number one pick, and if you haven't seen this, I mean, really, I'm totally kidding. This would be the other star of Night of the Comet. I picked because it stars Ms. Kelly Maroney. And interestingly enough, it also has a quick part in it with Paul Bartel and Mary Warnoff playing characters named the exact same thing as they were named in Eating Raoul.
Oh my gosh.
Because I'm assuming that Jim Warnowski, the guy who did the movie, was intending to pay homage to Eating Raoul. So
probably.
I would assume. So yes, it is 1986's Chopping Mall, also known as Killbots. And it's, Kelly Maroney's in it. Really, there's no other than Paul Bartel and Mary Warnoff. Oh, Dick Miller has a very quick part in it.
Oh, Dick Miller.
Oh, God. Anything Dick Miller's in just immediately goes up like 8 points of awesome because Dick Miller.
WWII from Gremlins.
Yeah. Barbara Crampton is in it. Barbara Crampton was in. You ever see Reanimator? We've talked about this.
Okay.
She was in the original Reanimator. She. I hate when I brain fart on a character's name. Aye. She was Bruce Abbott's girlfriend, and if you've seen Reanimator, which hopefully everyone has, but she's done several movies with Stuart Gordon. She was also in From Beyond. She's done lots of stuff. So yeah. She's in it, and there's this really cool scene where one of the killbots like shoots, I won't say who, in the head, and their head literally explodes, which was pretty messy. And it was directed by Jim Warnowski, who did tons and tons of Corman films. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you go on YouTube, there's a fun like Q&A video that the director, Jim Wynorski, I hope I'm saying his name right, and mm-hmm. Kelly did together at some screening for Chopping Mall. And they tell some really cool stories about like how the fact they originally screened the movie and it people had a really like bad reaction to it. They just didn't like it at all. And there was like, you know, they didn't think it was going to make any money. And then where they got the idea for the name, they changed the name to Chopping Mall, and how they got the idea. It's a very funny story. So if you get a chance, you know, go on YouTube, check that out. So that is my number one pick, Chopping Mall. And like I said, the real connection is that Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenoff were in three movies out of our six.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. Well
played. Is that kind of reminiscent of our Bruce Campbell episode where the same Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell, those people all kind of ran in the same circles?
But yeah, except those were all movies based around Bruce Campbell's career. So that kind of makes sense.
Well, maybe these are all around Mary Warrenoff.
These were at least like, this wasn't like the Mary Warrenoff episode where Paul Bartel would just keep popping. No, this is what's cool about this is we have six completely disparate movies. I mean,
yeah that's
nothing
true.
In common. Oh, except that they were all somehow connected to Night of the Comet, and they still had both of them in it. So anyway, I really need to go to bed now. So on that note, I guess we will go ahead and wrap this puppy up. This has been an hour and odd minutes, and we apologize. Hopefully you like long episodes. That's what she said. So we will go ahead.
I don't apologize.
No, I don't either. Screw it. Yeah, it is fun. I figured if they wanted to turn us off, they did it a long time ago. Yeah, so sorry, Dad. We will go ahead now and finish things up by going and telling you a few of the, like, what we like to call the housekeeping part, where if you want to go to the website, check us out. We've got new stuff almost getting posted every day. We've got several people contributing now. We've got a new writer, Dave, who's writing the Cinematic Essentials. He did a review on Do the Right Thing. He's got a couple more coming up.
Yeah,
that are really good.
Awesome reviews.
Sherry does It Came from the 80s, although so many of her stuff are like referring to like midnight movies that she went to in the 80s, but a lot of them are like 70s. So I feel like we might need to come up with like a title that encompasses, so she doesn't feel so like constrained to just that decade. Cause I feel like she could touch on stuff from all decades. We've got a couple other people who, you know, we actually have changed our quizzes by this point that you're hearing this. We aren't doing the letter quiz right now. I'm not saying we'll never do it again. I hope we do it again. But Dale, the guy who contributed, you know, we talked about, you know, just kind of putting that on hiatus for a little bit. And so we're doing some different type of quizzes, you know, give us your feedback. Let us know if you like it, but we're getting to a place where we've got something up there almost every single day. You know, we're not quite there, but we're getting there to where there's going to be stuff up there almost every day. So come check us out at ForgottenFlicks.com, and that's Flicks with an X, although if you type it in the other way, it redirects. So, you know, that's the website. And we also, if you want to leave us any feedback, you can leave it at feedback@ForgottenFlicks.com. And if you want to leave us voicemail feedback, which we always love, and you will get played on the show. It may be the next show. It might be the one following, but you will get played eventually. Jason?
Definitely. Love getting feedback by voicemail. Give us a call at area code 206-203-0491. And as we've said in the past, it is all long distance applies if you so have it on your phone.
Yeah. I need to ask somebody if they've run into, like, if they're charged for that. I don't think no one said anything the ones we've gotten. So I don't know.
No.
I mean, probably just use a disclaimer anyway. But and don't forget, if you'd like to follow Jason or myself on Flitter, he is twitter.com/FlicksSidekick, and I am twitter.com/ForgottenFlicks. So you can follow us on Twitter, and of course, don't want to forget it, iTunes. If you would like to subscribe to the podcast, check us out on iTunes. You just, you know, go in and search for us. We're in there. And leave us a review. We actually, and I'm glad I said that so I didn't forget, because I'd have felt like an ass clown. But we got three, last time I checked, maybe since this podcast is being recorded earlier than it's going out, it could be more between now and then. Hint, hint. but we had 3 5-star reviews, which gave us a 5-star average on iTunes. So we actually cannot friggin' believe it. And this is not fake humility, people. Seriously. We cannot even fathom how the hell we. And I know you're gonna be like, well, they just got done saying they had three listeners, Dad.
Three reviews.
And 2 months, so, and they got three reviews. Wow, I wonder if there's any connect. No, seriously, that it isn't, because believe me, none of them would have bothered. My dad would be like, yeah, really? Yeah.
I don't think any of my family knows how to use iTunes.
Yeah,
so,
my dad my dad barely knows how to use a keyboard. So,
it's all good.
Yeah, he would have started typing it like a month ago, and he'd still be going at it. He's like, okay, Dad, just move over. Let me type, for love of God. So, anyway, but yeah, we got three awesome five-star reviews. They were so nice and like, I was like, I wonder if they picked the wrong podcast to put this down for.
They're writing about the Nerdist.
What it was. Yeah, they're like, oh, God, I love you, Chris Hardwick.
That's okay. We'll take it anyway.
Yeah, we'll take it. Totally. I totally will mooch off other people's reviews. But yeah, if you could, you'll leave us a review, because I know the more reviews we get, the higher up the charts we go. Mm-hmm. So if you could leave us a review, you know, preferably positive. Our fragile egos can't take it. And, you know, if, you know, but if you don't like tangents, then I'm guessing it's not going to be. But yeah, we really appreciate it. It was wonderful. Awesome. Fantastic. So iTunes, you know, go ahead and make sure you check us out there.
Definitely.
And I guess on that note, Jason, anything else you'd like to say to finish us up?
No, last thing I want to say is I am so psyched about Kelly Maroney saying that she listens to the podcast.
Yeah. Well, what I'm psyched is that we actually got that friggin' drop. And just so you know, folks, I hope you don't find that drop annoying, because it's pretty much it's the only one we have, and we're going to milk the hell out of it.
Okay, all you teenage comet zombies, listen up. This is Kelly Maroney, or Samantha Belmont, one-third owner of the greater Los Angeles Basin, and you are listening to Forgotten Flicks. Yeah.
Hey, all you teenage comet zombies.
It was perfect. She sounded just like she sounded in the movie. It was awesome.
Absolutely.
Oh, God, it was great.
It was phenomenal. Yes.
So, anyway.
That's all I got to say.
Enough of the geek-gasming.
Enough.
Yes. We will now can...
peace out.
We will now finish out our show by telling you to remember... Oh, my God, folks. I just screwed it up. How could I do this? And the whole time I think to myself, I'm not going to have to edit this episode. Screw it. I'm not editing this episode. But you know what? I don't think I'm going to edit that part either.
Still not editing.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm still not. So, until next time, remember... A flick is only forgotten if you're not talking about it.